I want to say something about the title in their own language, Asian Women's Theology. I take the title in their own language from the Pentecost experience, the Pentecost event that we have with the appearance of the Holy Spirit, this miracle that people heard the gospel in their own language. What we don't have in that story is anything about whether they could talk to each other, which strikes me as very odd, and it makes it a hard model when we try to talk about being inclusive in any way, because we don't know then what to do with particularity. We say, yes, you be you, and you be you, and you be you, but we don't know quite how to talk to each other. And so in this series of three, what I'm trying to do is listen to what women in the third world are hearing and listen to what they're saying and learn from that. In their own language then refers to how God speaks to each of us in our own language, in our own life experience, language being both literal and metaphorical to mean where we're at, who we are, where we live, our needs, all of that. In their own language refers then to what women of Asia hear, and in their own language refers to what women of Asia speak. Now I should say, in this session I'm relying primarily on women who are natives of Asia, who may or may not live there anymore, but who would not define themselves as Asian Americans, although there's a whole sector of American feminist theology growing that takes into account the Asian American experience. Asian women's theology, just a couple words about that. What I mean by that it's done by women, taking account of their own experiences and informed by those three parts of their identity, that they are women, that they are Asian, and that they are Christian. Now, there are some other parts to that I'll say more about. Theology in this context is the whole range of religious expression, from the grassroots kinds of things that women do when they talk to each other over their work, to the kind of formalized things that you can see in these books that I've given you there as a sort of bibliography. Let me say again just a few words about each of them. This book, With Passion and Compassion, Third World Women Doing Theology, is essays written as part of a process initiated by women who are members of the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians, which culminated in a large meeting in Mexico City in 1986. And I think, no, that's not the one. This one, New Eyes for Reading, comes from the World Council of Churches. It is one of the stronger volumes on Asian women's stuff. The pieces in here from Asia aren't as strong, I think, as the ones from Africa are, but that may be just what I'm reading and what I'm looking for. This has a lot of Asian pieces, and it has a good bibliography, so if you're interested in the topic and you want to go on. Inheriting Our Mother's Gardens, Feminist Theology and Third World Perspective includes women of a variety of minority groups in North America, which the others do not. It also has a very good bibliography. And then this one, Women in the Church and Women in the Third World, Empirical Studies, has relevant today two real interesting pieces, one on images of Chinese women in missionary work, and one, Assumptions About Indian Women Underlying Protestant Church Politics and Programs from the 40s to the 80s. Okay. Then I should say something about why I'm doing this. This is a new interest for me. Until this point, most of my work has come at a variety of points of intersection between the church, women, and America. And I'm expanding to learn some new things about the church and women around the world. So it's new material for me. Some of you may know more about it than I do. Be sure and speak up. Tell me if I'm wrong or if you have questions about things I might know. Don't hesitate to just break in with those. What I'm going to emphasize is what's distinctive although there is much that's similar to American feminist theology, particularly if we look at things like biblical interpretation. It's very evident in this material that these women are familiar with people like Elizabeth Schussler Fierens and Rosemary Ruther and Letty Russell, and they've read all of that stuff. And so when they talk about the Bible, it sounds very much, at least methodologically, like what you would hear in American circles. So I'm not going to talk about that because that's similar. Okay, the structure, I'm going to begin with a quotation from a woman in, Hong Kong. Then I'll say something about the Asian background, something about themes, and then turn to look particularly at work by one woman from Korea. Okay. There will be lots of quotations. And that's a real conscious choice on my part because of wanting to hear in someone else's words, even if they're in translation. And a lot of this, of course, is in translation. So, from the essay, God Weeps With Our Pain, by Cao Pu Lan from Hong Kong, you ask me what shape feminist theology in Asia will take. Will it start with Beyond God the Father, a reference to Mary Daly, and finish with Beginning from the Other End, reference to Letty Russell? Will it be colored by the rhetoric of middle-class elites or heavily laden with socialist terminology? Will it yield a systematic analysis of the situation of women in Asia or just an emotional outburst like that of a lunatic? For these questions, I have no answer. I only know that feminist theology in Asia will be a cry, a plea, and an invocation. It emerges from the wounds that hurt, the scars that do not disappear, the stories that have no ending. Feminist theology in Asia is not written with a pen. It is inscribed on the hearts of many who feel pain and yet dare to hope. Now, those of you who were here last night will recognize something I said that I see being characteristic of third world women's theology, which is this having pain or suffering or sacrifice acknowledged, spoken, and in the very next breath, hope. That those are real close together all the time. Okay. And then she goes on to write, feminist theology in Asia is a story of suffering. What else can it be? Women suffer from the millennia-old prejudices and discriminations of the male-dominated Eastern cultures, from rampant socio-political exploitations, and from their structural vulnerability. These big burdens join hand in hand to rob a woman of her personhood, to render her a nobody. And those are separated, so it's nobody, not nobody. Because suffering touches the innermost part of her being, she feels the pain of the suffering God. A God who cries out from the cross, who suffered under the oppressive Jewish tradition. A God who was put to death by the military and political forces, who was stripped, naked, insulted, and spat upon. Didn't the prophet Isaiah say he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hid their eyes? God has taken the risk to become a human being and experiences personally what it means to be a nobody. The term nobody in this essay in particular comes out of the context of sexual exploitation of women in Asia. And she describes in another part of this essay how that renders a woman a nobody. The background. How did Christianity get to Asia? Of course, it was an imported religion, as Christianity is imported in almost every place that it exists. It's imported to Europe, although we tend to forget that because Christianity grew up along with European culture. The two are so closely linked that we forget that it's an import. It's imported to the U.S. and it's imported all around the world. Legendarily, St. Thomas took Christianity to India. so in the very first generation. The historical documentation for that is shaky. So we might want to say that we know for sure, whenever I think of this, it reminds me of all the stuff about Leif Erikson really discovering North America, you know. It makes my heart kind of excited, but I have to admit, historically, the evidence isn't really very good, and so, okay, Columbus is the European who came first, right? St. Thomas may have gotten to India, but undoubtedly St. Francis Xavier, one of the first Jesuits, got to India and to Japan and planned to go to China pretty much during Luther's lifetime. Okay, that's hard to fathom for me, that the Jesuits were already engaged in what we now call global mission in the 1500s. The fortune of Christianity in Asia has been a story of up and down, and it's very, very varied. If any of you are familiar with Shusaku Endo's novel Silence, you know something about how Christianity in Japan had a period of flourishing and then was suppressed and then revived again once Commodore Perry opened up Japan to Western intercourse again in the 1900s. And of course, as I said about Africa, throughout the continent of Asia, and I put up this map, I just was looking in the library for a map, and I found this map, and it's an old map, and it tells us, you know, Asia is just cut in half. So it's hard to see how huge Asia is, but it's gigantic. It goes, you know, kind of from here all the way across around the whole of Koinonia and back around over to here. And I suppose if Hawaii wasn't with the United States, we might call that Asia too, you know. So it's gigantic. And how Christianity has found a place or tried to chip out a place in those areas varies very much from place to place. I'm making huge generalizations. But in almost every place except the Philippines, Christianity is a minority religion. And that's very, very different than the American situation. I think because of the effects of Spanish colonization and the Spanish influence in the Philippines. And it may, I mean, I'm not an expert by any means on Philippine history, but my guess is that the small population of an island, a country made up of islands, allowed a stronger imposition. But then you would say, but what? Why not Japan? Well, things were different in Japan, and it's an extraordinarily delicate thing to talk about why Christianity is different in Asia than in Africa. A century ago, people talked about it very blithely with an evolutionary theory of religions and said, well, African religions were more primitive and Asian religions were more sophisticated, so of course it was easier to overcome primitive religions than sophisticated religions. That vocabulary we don't think very well of anymore, and the theory we don't think very well of either, because the tribal religions are not necessarily unsophisticated. They don't have the same, perhaps what we would say is they don't have the same strong infrastructure. They aren't as resistant somehow. And that's one reason why syncretism is a big issue in African Christianity, but it's not a non-issue in Asian Christianity. And that brings very nicely to then one of the next important things to say about Asia. It has an incredibly rich cultural and religious tradition. 7 major linguistic areas. And I have a friend who's part of the ELCA Asian Caucus, and she said it's just incredible because we meet, and someone from India and someone from Korea, they can't speak to each other in their native languages. That's just, it's not, there's hardly any continuity at all. And of course, that's all the more so in Asia. And then there's a rich religious pluralism as well. Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, all have their birthplace in Asia, all have strong followings, Shintoism in Japan, and then there are also shamanistic traditions as well. So there's a, and they overlap, okay? So that the pluralism isn't segmented, as we sociologists tell us about the Netherlands, that they have these pillars, and there are Roman Catholics, and there are Protestants of this kind, everybody's real separate from each other. The Asian situation is different. Things are more in layers, and people's lives intersect with those layers in a variety of ways. So a rich religious and cultural heritage coexisting with economic disparity and oppression. And in the continental meeting from the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians, their final statement from that meeting in Manila in 1985 lays out some of the specificity of the oppression that women in Asia encounter, having said that oppression and suffering are generally a part of women's experience. Let me quote some of the specifics that were laid out in that meeting. In all spheres of Asian society, women are dominated, dehumanized, and dewomanized. They are discriminated against, exploited, harassed, sexually used, abused, and viewed as inferior beings who must always subordinate themselves to so-called male superiority. In the home, church, law, education, and media, women have been treated with bias and condescension. In Asia and all over the world, the myth of the subservient, servile Asian woman is blatantly peddled to reinforce the dominant male stereotype image. And a place we often see that is in airline ads. Now, I don't think airline ads to any country are very good, but Asian ones do often perpetuate this myth of the subservient, servile Asian woman. Indian women still live under the shadow of a patriarchal tradition that manifests itself in violence against women, namely the dowry system, bride burning, forced sterilization, and sex determination tests. Hindu mythology, which depicts women as the seductress or the evil one, incapable of moral self-control, has helped to institutionalize these unjust practices. Filipinos, like many of their Asian sisters, are subjected to job discrimination, are exposed to health hazards in factories, multinational corporations, and export processing zones. Because of the severe economic crisis and the advent of sex tourism and the presence of U.S. bases, many Filipino women and children have been plunged into prostitution. Many leave home to become migrant workers in hostile alien lands. Furthermore, many are raped, tortured, imprisoned, and killed for their political beliefs. In Malaysia, there is a resurgence of religious fundamentalist trends, widening economic inequalities, worsening communal relations, and diminishing political freedom. Women are the worst hit. In Japan, the male-oriented emperor system is still firmly established, and we've just seen that again as the new emperor has been installed. And even as the people continue to bear the stigma of nuclear havoc wreaked upon them, Japan steadily moves into a highly dangerous technological stage with its concomitant deadly hazards. In Korea, people suffer from pain of separation and division of their homeland. They live under a government preoccupied with national security and militarism, while remaining in the grip of the Confucian family law that makes men absolute masters in all aspects of life. Oppression of women cuts across class, caste, creed, race, profession, and age. But even among women, there is division and misunderstanding because of differences in perception. Along with that notion that women are very subject to oppression and suffering in Asia, we have to put the exceptional women, and we can name them, people like Indira Gandhi, Mrs. Imelda Marcos, and even Cory Aquino, that we see women of great wealth and power, so that the oppression is not distributed equally among women. Okay, some themes. We've already begun to move into themes. There's a general shared concern in what I have read of Asian women's theology about foreign domination, about militarization, state repression, and racial strife. Those are themes that come up differently in different areas. How they're manifest in India is, of course, different than how they're manifest in Korea. But they're similar. Concern about foreign domination and all the different ways that that takes place, whether it's political domination or cultural domination. It's still there. And the desire to preserve culture. I spoke last night about a student of mine who had been in Java. And her struggle as an American feminist to understand Javanese women's expression of feminism. One of the examples she gave me of this was that the Javanese language has several levels. And you use a different language, a different set of constructions, and perhaps even vocabulary, depending on who you're speaking to. You speak up to your parents and down to your children, up to men and down to servants, that sort of thing. And Sydney said to this friend of hers, didn't that bother her? Because, of course, Sydney was a good American egalitarian. And this Javanese young woman said, no, it doesn't, because my culture is dying. And if my language dies, my culture will die. And a concern about domination, loss of identity as Javanese is one of the concerns. Another common theme is the appropriation of the experience of motherhood, both as mothers and as children of mothers, as a resource for theological reflection and as a model of the church. This may not come through quite as strongly in the Asian stuff as it did in the African materials, but it's still there. And the woman whose work I'm going to review for you more explicitly uses the experience of her mother and her birth mother as an important resource for her theological reflection. That's, as I said last night, unlike a lot of American feminism that's afraid to make use of the resource of notions of motherhood for fear of being equated with motherhood. Okay, that fear doesn't seem to be operative in Third World women's theology in quite the same way that it is in American women's theology. The goal is a better society with female leaders. It's a dual goal. A better society, a change in the way whichever culture these women live in, with the church taking part in that. There's not a strong separation between church life and other life. The church should be a part of it. And in that making of something better, Asian women are asking that Asian women be leaders. Okay, and that's what makes them distinctive as female theologians, as opposed to just male theologians who may or may not see that as part of the new, better society. Within this, there is a concern for enculturation, which one of these women I have read relates to incarnation. As God became incarnate, took on human form, so too the gospel and the church must become enculturated. She says it must be more than mere adaptation. Theology can't just change a few little parts, but we have to think in new ways. It makes me think of an essay I read recently by a teacher of rhetoric who went back to a piece he'd written a long time ago called What Every Man Should Know, or What It Takes to Be an Educated Man, or something like that. And he thought he could just fix it up by changing the pronouns. And he discovered that it was full of a bunch of assumptions about how the world worked that he couldn't continue with if he wanted it to be for an audience that he realized had both men and women in it. And what he wanted to do was make it what every woman should know, what every educated woman should know, and he found out it had to be different. We have to change the way we think, not just add on. But at the same time, not lose a critical edge. And in those specificities of oppression that I read to you, you could hear that the Asian women at that meeting in Manila did not point their finger only to Western culture and only to Christianity as causes of the problem. You know, the things that were listed in India, for example, had to do much more with Indian culture, although not entirely. The thing about bride burning. Do you know about bride burning? The dowry system is a kind of barter. And there's a phenomenon that seems to be growing in India whereby the groom's family will demand things. A motorcycle is something you read about a lot, that a motorcycle is part of the dowry. A refrigerator. And if the bride's family doesn't come through, or if the groom's family decides they want more and the bride's family isn't willing to increase the dowry, there are mysterious kitchen fires, and the bride dies. Now, the dowry system is Indian, and it comes out of an Indian culture, but the motorcycles and the refrigerators are modern and in part import from the Western world. I don't think we can take total responsibility for refrigerators anymore, but it's a mixture that creates the problem. Well, something then about enculturation is ultimately the goal of building a new humanity. Then it is not the task of a few experts, but of the people. Similarly, true liberation can be achieved only if it emerges from the people's own struggle, not from that of a few elites. And then we go on to here. Finally, we spoke of the twin tasks of enculturation and liberation needed in Asia today. Enculturation is deeper than mere adaptation. It is often referred to as a dialogue between gospel and culture, but we must be careful that in our zeal for enculturation, we do not destroy our ability to criticize culture. There are aspects of culture and religion that have been oppressive and even dehumanizing, especially for women. Women in the church involved in enculturation have to see that this important work, which is a long-term process, is it accompanied by a serious analysis of the local culture and religion to detect which aspects or developments of the culture and religion are life-giving and liberating and which are domesticating and alienating. This analysis of religion should be assiduously applied even to our own. There is not a preoccupation with the maleness of Jesus. It's mentioned, but it doesn't seem to be the same problem that it sometimes is for American feminist theologians. Instead, what is lifted out from Jesus is suffering. And I'll come back to that. I want to highlight one other theme, which is that Asian women's theology is markedly ecumenical and interfaith. And of course, that has to do with context. Because in a situation in which Christianity is a minority religion, in which many of these theologians who I've been reading come from families that include members who are not Christian, there has to be dialogue with other religions. You can't just say, get away, bad, awful. You have to talk to those people and sometimes learn from them. And that's very, very clear in the Asian materials. Okay, what they seem to focus on about Jesus is the suffering. It's closely related, I think, to a concern about sexual exploitation. You heard some of that in the specifics of oppression. I was reading the most recent issue of Harper's upstairs, and the classifieds are full of those ads. Asian women by man. And the advent of sexual and tourism. Go to Singapore and lots of Asian, young Asian women are prostitutes there, specifically for tourists. Perhaps a legacy of military action by outsiders in that area. And the sexual exploitation is related to other kinds of oppression. These theologians are no dummies. They realize that the dynamics of oppression are similar, whether it's the caste system or prostitution. And they focus then very much on suffering and its result. Here we have, by a woman from the Philippines, like Jesus' suffering, women's active suffering. And there you hear a kind of parallel to the African stuff about the difference between being made into a sacrifice and sacrificing. The first passive, the second active. Like Jesus' suffering, women's active suffering has salvific value for them, for from the perspective of faith, every suffering, whether personally or vicariously experienced for the sake of building a more just world, falls within the ambit of salvation history. This historic salvific process culminated in the coming of Jesus Christ to inaugurate God's reign. All suffering, all hoping, all struggle ultimately find meaning from the viewpoint of the reign of God that Jesus proclaimed. The assurance that God's reign will come in its fullness is Jesus Christ, crucified and risen, the anchor of hope. Jesus today in the Philippines is simultaneously going through his agony, being crucified and alive in the struggle of women from their captivity toward full humanity in a just, egalitarian society. Now that's a sort of analytical, theological way of talking about suffering. This piece from Korea comes at it from a very different way, by telling a little story about a bell. In the National Museum in Korea, in the capital of ancient Silla Kingdom, is a beautiful bell. The Silla Kingdom at the time enjoyed peace, but the king, a devout Buddhist, wanted to protect his people from foreign invasion. His advisors suggested he build a huge temple bell to show the people's devotion to the Buddha. A specialist in the art of bell making was commissioned, but despite his skill and care, he failed time and again to produce a bell with a beautiful sound. Finally, he went back to the Council of Religious Leaders. After a long discussion, they concluded the best way to give a beautiful tone to the bell was to sacrifice a pure young maiden. Soldiers were sent to find and fetch such a young girl. Coming upon a poor mother in a farm village with a small daughter, they took the child away while she cried out piteously, "Mother, oh mother." When the molten lead and iron were prepared, the little girl was thrown in. At last, the bell maker succeeded. The bell, called the Emile Bell, because she called Emile, Emile, oh mother, made a sound more beautiful than any other. When it rang, most people praised the art that had produced such a beautiful sound. But whenever the mother whose child had been sacrificed heard it, her heart broke anew. Her neighbors who knew of her sacrifice and pain could not hear the beautiful tone without pain either. Only those who understand the sacrifice can feel the pain. Others just enjoy the sound. The salvation of humankind has not come through those who are comfortable and unconcerned, but only through the one who shared the suffering of all humankind. The women must have loved Jesus very much for the way he related to them and shared with them as equals. Okay. So it seems like in the writings that I have been reading of Asian women theologians, for them, it's Jesus' suffering, which is his primary characteristic, because that touches their own suffering. It reminds me a great deal of stuff I've read about medieval mysticism and especially medieval women mystics, and in a book about their food practices. And Carolyn Bynum, the author of this book, says that in medieval mystical theology, people understood that they knew God most closely in human incarnation, that is, in Jesus, and particularly in Jesus' suffering, because to be most human was to suffer. And if you know anything about medieval European history, there was a lot of suffering going on. It was people's day-to-day experience. And so women who fasted thought that by suffering, then that was when they were closest to God. There are some resonances to these things. Okay, let me just stop for a minute before I move on to talk about an essay entitled Following Naked Dancing and Long Dreaming, to see if you want to make comments or...
Choosing their
right.
Suffering, so it seems
yeah.
to be very different.
Yeah, and that's an important difference. That one of the reasons I think there is still a significant resonance is that their understanding of God in suffering came out of a world that had a lot of obvious physical suffering. So that although those particular women chose things that we think are kind of, my students just hated this book because they couldn't imagine why these women would do the things that they did. But it's the context filled with suffering that's a similarity. Yeah. And that's an important distinction to make between active chosen suffering and passive unchosen suffering. Okay. Chung Hung Kyung from Korea was educated at a women's university in Korea, where she has a BA and an MA from there. She studied at Claremont School of Theology and is currently a doctoral candidate at Union in New York. She's written an essay for this book, Inheriting Our Mother's Gardens, called Following Naked Dancing and Long Dreaming. It's very autobiographical. We learn about her life, and we learn about how she uses her life and the life of her family as one of the resources for her theological reflection. She does other kinds of theological reflection. Some of her Christology is reflected in With Passion and Compassion. Her mother encouraged her to study. And she describes it as a very unusual experience for a Korean girl, that her mother always would tell her when a feast was coming, you don't need to help in the kitchen, go and study. Go on with your education. Her mother also encouraged her not to marry quickly, perhaps not even to marry. And if she was going to marry a Westerner. Because her mother, like the mother of the African woman we looked at last night, seemed to think that Western men were less sexist than Asian men. And in part, Cheung thinks her mother got that from movies. Okay. And thought that Western men, American men, treated women with more respect. Okay. I don't know which movie she was seeing. Probably movies in the 50s. Okay. Officially, her mother was a Christian. But a Christian who also was very influenced by Confucianism, and a Christian who also took part in activities around the Buddhist temple. So a Christian who brought pieces together. She gives an example of that. Her father was a Confucian, not a Christian at all. And so they would do all the rituals for ancestors that Confucian tradition prescribes. And one day the little girl said to her mother, why did we do this and was that okay and how does this all work out? And her mother told her that because Jesus is very busy, the ancestors help Jesus with his work, much like a secretary helps with the work. That was a way she made sense out of you putting these two things together. It sounds kind of like what some of us were told about angels. You know, what do angels do? Well, angels help Jesus, and you know. While Chung was studying in the U.S., her mother died. She came back to Korea 3 years after her mother's death, and she learned that she had another mother. The first mother is the one referred to in Naked Dancing. The second one is referred to in Long Dreaming. Her birth mother was what we would nowadays call a surrogate. There's a Korean word for that. Apparently it was not an uncommon practice in Korea. The Korean word means seed receiver. After 20 years of marriage, her mother had not born any children. Her father wanted a child and said to the mother, go and find someone, a seed receiver, to bear me a child. The mother found someone. The father said, no, I don't want that woman, and went and found this other woman who then gave birth. She was very badly treated by the family, particularly by the mother, and there are all kinds of resonances to the Sarah and Hagar story as I read this about how Sarah didn't want Hagar around. So the birth mother was silent. She followed her daughter's life. She had pictures that she'd gotten from the father, but she did not impose herself into the daughter's life at all. In part, she did that because although it was a legal, legitimate thing for her father, for the father to have done, it was not a well-respected thing, and it would have diminished the daughter's place if it was known that she was the child of a seed receiver. The birth mother was a Buddhist who participated in shamanistic practices, and that's, she had a birth dream about her daughter and what she would do. That's the long dreaming. But she has become a Pentecostal. So Chung lays out for us in her two mothers most of the religious options in Korea, except the Unification Church. You don't hear anything about the Unification Church. She also, though she doesn't highlight this, has in her own life embodied something of one of the main parts of Korean context, which is division into two parts, that she has two mothers. And how is she to make sense of this? She writes that this is a story of two mothers, three women bound together by love and embittered by a tradition that doesn't respect women. How does she make sense out of their religions? Listen to what she says about it, what she writes. Oops. Book 66, she says, my two mothers mixed and matched all the spiritual resources they found around them and established their own comfortable religious cosmos in their hearts. Their center of spirituality was not Jesus, Buddha, Confucius, or any of the various fortune tellers. All these religious personalities and spirits helped my mother in various stages of their life journeys, but none dominated their inner life. The real center for their spirituality was life itself. Now that came up also in African materials. It's also very present in the Asian stuff. They consciously and unconsciously, mostly the latter, selected the life-giving aspects of each religion and rejected the death-giving ones. As Alice Walker said of her great-grandmother's spirituality, my mothers knew even without knowing it. It was a matter of the epistemology of the body. Maybe their conscious selves could not catch up with what their body said because their conscious selves were not ready for the, quote, new paradigm. Orthodoxy and heresy debates were meaningless to them since the words themselves were unfamiliar. Most Korean women of my mother's ages, could not go beyond primary school education. Their fathers did not send them to school. Higher education was for boys. Boys, therefore, learned how to fight against heresies, how to safeguard their narrow, privileged circles for orthodoxy. Girls did not learn fancy words in their primary schools. My mothers made chemical changes in traditional religions by infusing them with the liberative thrust of already existing religions. Since women were excluded from the public process of determining the meaning of religion, they were free to carve out a religion of their own without the constraints of orthodoxy. Their imposed freedom allowed them to develop in private a religious organic whole that enabled them to survive and liberated them in the midst of their struggle for full humanity. And that's, I think, a not uncommon view, that those who are on the outside, who don't have the center to protect, are able to see new things, have what she describes as imposed freedom. They're able to see in new ways. And in fact, this, you know, one is called New Eyes for Reading, making the claim that women's experience, just as third world experience, allows us to see what we couldn't see otherwise. And that's the listening, not just with women of other cultures, to hear what the gospel sounds like to them, but also listening to them to help us see in new ways. Okay, excuse me for that. I want to name my mother's distinctive spirituality as survival liberation-centered syncretism. The heart of their spirituality was the life power that sustained and liberated them. Life-giving power is the final criterion by which the validity of any religion is judged. In another piece of an essay where someone draws on Chan's work, we hear a more analytic perspective from her about Christology, where she suggests that in the Korean context, theologians can draw on a tradition of shamanist exorcism as a way of understanding who Jesus is. Not that Jesus is a shamanist exorcist, but that's in the culture. It's something people understand. So that she wants to discuss Jesus as one who exorcises the Han of Mingzheng women. Jesus as one who exorcises this Han, which means resentment, indignation, and will to overcome, combined with defeat, resignation, and nothingness. Han. Jesus as one who exorcises Han from Mingzheng women, women who are oppressed, alienated, and uneducated. One last thing to finish my formal presentation. A piece of poetry written by a woman from Sri Lanka entitled The New Woman. The hands which gently tend the leaves will now help to banish darkness. They'll work hard to put down evil and to raise up for all new life. The hands which gently tend the leaves will help to nourish all that is good. They'll work hard to weed out poverty and to bring in new culture and art. The hands which gently tend the leaves will show new ways for humankind. They'll work hard to build those structures in which truth and right will be found. Yeah, and I'm trying to put my finger on it. You don't have direct, but what is the case is a real effort to make use of that tradition. And as you can hear, the birth mother, of course, was a poor woman. And so Chung makes use of her mother's experience. The first essay in Inheriting Our Mother's Gardens is by a woman from Hong Kong, Mothers and Daughters, Writers and Fighters. And there, that this woman, Kung Pulan, also uses her mother and her mother-in-law, who are much less privileged than she. Most of the Asian writers that I have been reading tend to be the first generation with some kind of privilege.
I'm thinking of like in Latin America, we have like the Sol and Tanami.
Yeah, no, nothing comparable to that I have seen.
Yeah, where people will be going out and getting quotes from them.
No, although some will use, there is a story or, you know, folk tales and that kind of thing about what women are like or what women's lives are like. And so there's a conscious effort to stay in contact with that and to honor that, both insofar as that experience is articulated in Christian terms and insofar as it's not. Yeah. Now, I used mostly Far Eastern Asian stuff. One of the things I didn't fit in that I just found wonderful, and I'll just give you the one sentence from it. It's the essay called An Emerging Spirituality of Asian Women, which is, again, from the Philippines and Korea, about spirituality, which is a big part of the contemporary American feminist conversation nowadays about feminist spirituality. And I always have students coming in and saying, I want to study spirituality. I had a student last fall. I want to study women and advertising around the world and ethics and spirituality. I sort of looked at her like, yeah, I know it. I know you're an econ major, but this is too much, you know. And what do you mean by spirituality? What do you mean by spirituality? She worked on that. I don't know that she came to a really satisfactory answer. But here from the Philippines and Korea, I found a way of talking about that I found really astonishing and very helpful. In Christian theology and practice, an old understanding of spirituality would more or less describe it as theology applied to daily life. There is, however, an emerging understanding of spirituality as the inner core made up of all experiences and encounters one has had in one's life, and out of which come motivations, inspirations, and commitments that make up one's life and decide it in a particular way. One might say it is the shape in which the Holy Spirit has molded herself into one's life. And that may account in part for what I've been saying to people for the past couple weeks is a tone in Third World Women's Theology that I find very attractive, and it's sort of we might call it the spirituality, and it does seem to be the way the Spirit molds herself into those lives. Much gentleness there. Hard gentleness. The theme, I don't know, a few years ago for the summer at Holden was gentle justice. And we see it very much in the way I think the gospel is heard and the way it is spoken in the language of Asian women.